Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You know what I love about this? You could never tell they were rich. It's all so classy and understated.
I'll make it up to you later.
Make it up to me now. Let's find a room. You must have a few.
You're so bad.
It is what rich, entitled people do when threatened. They conceal the ugly truths to protect themselves.
The community is in shock tonight over the gruesome discovery of a fourth grade mother found bludgeoned to death.
Hello and welcome back to episode 2 of Still Watching The Undoing. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you were just joining us, what we do every week on this podcast, we break down the latest episode of some show that we are watching sort of obsessively. We are just now wrapping up the end of We Are Who We Are, so you will have the last episode of that dropping in your feeds on Monday, but it is Sunday night. It is Undoing night. We are in episode 2 of The Undoing, so that is what we will be discussing right here, right now. Richard, welcome. You know, arrivederci to Italia. Welcome to New York.
To a hellish, haunted New York. Yeah. It's funny. It's funny how the filming style in this episode is different in a way, because like it's our lead kind of descending into paranoia and suspicion and everything. And so last week I was like, oh, it's so nice. It's a grim story, but it's so nice to be in like the Upper East Side. And this week I didn't feel that way.
So this episode one, the premiere was called The Undoing. This is called The Missing. The titular missing is, of course, Hugh Grant's character, Jonathan, Dr. Jonathan. We got, you know, you can always email us if you're interested in engaging in this show. You can always email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. The bulk of the emails we got this week were about the end of the other show we're covering, so actually didn't get much on The Undoing yet. But we did get one person emailing us to let us know that they definitely thought that Dr. Jonathan Frazier, as played by Hugh Grant, would have an electric toothbrush and not an analog toothbrush. So.
Your dentist listens to the podcast, Joanna.
Well, listen, you know, he likes to stay informed on what's happening in HBO, so
devotion.
if you have any other thoughts on The Undoing, we would love to hear them. stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. So our guest this week on the podcast is Lily Rabe, who plays Grace's seemingly one loyal friend in the show. Folks might know her best from her work on American Horror Story. She's also in this fantastic film from a few years ago called Miss Stevens. I really recommend it if you haven't seen it. So yeah, so stick around for our chat with the great Lily Rabe. But first, Richard and I want to talk about this episode, episode 2 of The Undoing. We've got a media explosion in this episode. Richard, how do you feel about the way that the media is depicted in stories like this, the vulturistic media.
Well, I mean, I have to say, like, I think in a lot of movies and TV shows, usually a crime story, but not always, where there's some kind of scandal that the show is trying to tell you is really a big deal. And like, everyone's, you know, you went viral, you're on the blogs, you're on the news. A lot of times I'm like, that wouldn't be on the news. Like, who cares, you know? But in this case, yes. Beautiful woman who is horribly murdered and their kid goes to this fancy school, I think it would be a big deal. So that didn't, what normally strikes me is kind of like overdoing it actually didn't in this case. I do wonder how many reporters these days are like leaning against crowd control barriers, waving microphones, like begging for a quote.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure that happens, but I've never seen it with my own eyes because I don't have to like stick a microphone at a movie and be like, are you good? Are you good? Like, I can just do that from the comfort of my own home.
Oh, I wish you would though, Richard.
Yeah, yeah. Mank.
Yeah. Cats, what's your comment?
Yeah. Well, I did do that for Cats, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Shaking a, you know, kitty litter. Yeah, so I think it was credible that this news story blew up. And I also think it's credible the way that the information about Grace's family started to seep into the school's, you know, gossip mill. That I think that these, you know, as we saw in the first episode, these people love to talk about each other and, you know, kind of get the dirt on things. I mean, who doesn't really? But so I felt like the undoing of this episode of Grace's once relatively comfortable life felt, really importantly, it felt like proportional. It was like, yep, I think this is proceeding as it might to some extent in real life.
So let's talk about, so we get two morning drop-offs for Grace. And in the first, she's still part of this like inner circle of moms. She's in the literal like circle of moms. And they're talking about the victim's husband, how he's a suspect, how it's always the husband, et cetera, et cetera. And then when she comes back another morning, she's now on the outside because her husband's a suspect. And, you know, the principal basically says, like, I don't think you should come in here anymore, stuff like that. Janelle Maloney's giving her the cold shoulder. Never want a Maloney cold shoulder. Like, that's the last thing you want. and the only lifeline she's being offered is by Lily Rabe's character. So I like that juxtaposition of, like, it wasn't even from last episode to this episode. It's like morning to morning, you're in, then you're out. And in this world, you can be out so quickly, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, and I think that Heidi Klum walking into frame saying that exactly, I think, was really helped drive that home.
So Grace is out, but her friend Sylvia, is played by Lily Rabe, is like, psst, come with me. I'm still your friend. Let's go to a diner so I can tell you terrible information about your husband. So we find out that in this episode that, not only is it, you know, was Jonathan having, an affair with this woman, not only is he missing, not only is, he left his cell phone behind suspiciously, but he's been fired from his job, for 3 months now, 3 months past, and that Sylvia knew about it because she was, working as a lawyer for him in some capacity. How do you feel about this betrayal, this undoing of the Hugh Grant, the charming, affable pediatric oncologist persona, Richard?
Well, here's another way that this episode in some ways felt credible, was that, like, you think, okay, so he's this like renowned pediatric oncologist at this big hospital, and they're going to fundraisers and they're talking about maybe auctioning off his services or whatever. Like, and it's like, no one would know that he wasn't working, but a big hospital like that with a prominent doctor having this fall from grace because of something, you know, in this B2 era of like that, they would want to keep that so quiet. So I really do believe that, like, with, you know, me, a lawyer knew and a couple other people knew, but otherwise, like, it was omerta. that felt right to me. But I love the way that Grace finds out this information in this very like intense interrogation scene, because it that is such a, I mean, I haven't acted in anything since college, but like, I would imagine that that is a really hard bit of acting, because Nicole Kidman doesn't want to, she doesn't want to suggest entirely that Grace knew nothing, but she doesn't want to, like, you know, you have to play a very fine line of like surprise, but also guardedness and shock and like, it's a tragedy that this thing has just, that's just been said to her is like changed her life forever. So it's a really terrific like bit of acting from her, and reminiscent, I think, in some ways of the end of, can I spoil the first season of Broadchurch?
I'll allow it. Yes.
Okay. You know, when like Olivia Colman finds out,
yeah,
that, who's the detective, finds out that her husband is the one who,
yeah,
did the murder. And that scene is like, oh, that's why Olivia Colman, like, you know, is who she is. Like, that scene's incredible. And I think this is another bit, a wonderful interrogation room piece of acting. And I love that the detectives, Edgar Ramirez in particular, are like so like relentless with it. They're not like concerned about her. Like, they're just like, you know, they're hammering away. That feels realistic to a certain extent. Yeah. And then this scene with Lily Rabe, where it's like, okay, yes, there, it was privileged information. She couldn't say anything to her friend, but is that also kind of like a delicious little secret for her to have, you know? And so that whole social dynamic, I think, is an interesting play. But throughout Nicole Kidman, I think, as she realizes more and more, like, oh, this looks really bad on a variety of fronts.
Oh, yeah.
Is just like, it's Nicole Kidman doing her thing, and it's great to watch.
I want to talk about that interrogation scene really quickly, because there's two line readings that I just like love from that scene. One was, I never knew that I always wanted to hear Edgar Ramirez say, according to Verizon, but the way he just says I'm not going to do his beautiful accent, but it's just like, it's really nice in his accent. And then Nicole Kidman saying, grossly custodial setting. I was just like, yes, bring your expertise to this interrogation. It was a great moment where she's like, I'm not some like, you know, flighty, you know, Upper East Side wife that you can push around. Like, I know some things about some things, and I know that this is out of line, what you're doing right now. So,
and it sort of brings to mind, like, when her character in Big Little Lies, like, kind of remembers she's a lawyer.
Yes, yes.
You know, and yeah, and it's that kind of like, oh, you thought I was just this one thing, but actually I have, you know, a particular set of knowledge and skills that come to bear here.
Well, and I feel like in the later scene, when Edgar Ramirez's character is in when they're like basically tossing her apartment looking for evidence, his character's name is Detective Joe Mendoza. I suppose I should call them by their character names. I feel like he treats her differently, like with a bit more. I mean, he's gentler with her, because I think that interrogation room scene is you know, a test. They're like, we don't know what she knows. We don't know how complicit she is. We don't know if she's hiding him. And I feel like good old Detective Joe here has made a decision that she is not protecting her husband, that she is as much in the dark. You know what I mean? Like, I think he got his answer on that. And so then he can afford to be a bit gentler with her in that subsequent scene.
Yeah. Yes. And I think the tricky thing is for Grace in that position, and I think that like he's kind of seeing how she reacts, is you have a basically split second to decide whether you're going to go all in and work with the police, or if you're going to like retreat and say lawyer, or like, you know, arrest me or let me go, and you know, circle the wagons around the family. And I think that, I mean, like, because both are shitty options, but like, and that have like really intense consequences. And I think watching her figure that out is interesting for us in the audience, but also like the detectives would be looking for that and be like, okay, like how genuine does this all seem? How calculated is this? And it seems she passed the test, I guess.
And what's interesting is, her father, the Donald Sutherland character, is very much like circle the wagons, like let's protect the family, sort of thing. The other character, like, speaking of her family, the other character that I want to mention their behavior in this episode, is her son, Henry, played by Noah Jupe. Is it Jupe? Am I like over zhuzhing his last
Jupe?
Name?
I think it's Jupe.
Jupe. He says like kind of multiple times, like, "Mom, you're acting crazy. Mom, like, there's a reasonable explanation for this. Mom, maybe Dad just doesn't have internet," stuff like that. Like, it feels like, I feel like her son is gaslighting her. and not in a, like, a overtly, like, calculated way necessarily, but just sort of like every time he tells her to calm down, I'm like, no, I think she's the exact level of hysterical she should be in this scenario. You know what I mean?
Maybe the son did it.
That's a fun guess.
Well, because he, like, I mean, I don't know, that just popped in my head, but like that scene where they're on the beach and he's like, "This is bullshit. We should be back. Like, you have, we have to fight it," or whatever. I got kind of annoyed because that always feels like a device where there has to be someone to be like, "No, let's do the opposite thing of what, you know." So there's tension in the scene. But because she's doing the right thing, get the hell out of town, like whatever, you know. But maybe there is more to his opposition than just like trying to establish, you know, dramatic tension.
I will say that like a couple of people that I interviewed around the show asked me who I thought did it, and I didn't know the answer, but in order to like sound clever, which is what I'm always trying to do, I was like, "Well, I don't think you hire Noah Jupe to be in something if you're not gonna ask him to do something," you know, sort of as you were saying with Olivia Colman and Broadchurch, if you're gonna ask them to do something kind of big. I don't have any, that might have been like maybe the most idiotic thing I've ever said. I don't have any evidence whether or not that's true or not, but you know, this kid is an incredibly good actor. So, you know, hopefully he's not just here to gaslight his mom and ask for a dog. the other thing I want to talk about is these flashbacks. Susanna Beer told me that she almost took all the flashbacks out of the show at one point. In like one edit pass through, she's like, maybe no flashbacks. And these flashbacks aren't really flashbacks. They're like perception memories sort of thing. So yeah. Like in one flash, Grace thinks of, you know, our poor murder victim here as like an angelic mom. And then in another flashback, she's like, you know, it's the sort of like a Madonna whore kind of thing. Like, mm-hmm. Who is Elena? Who was she to Jonathan? You know, and you know, even to the point where we see Elena like in a bus stop, like ad billboard thing. Do you like these subjective journeys into Grace's point of view?
I mean, I get that there, it's hard to like literalize like what Grace would be thinking, which is, yeah, she would probably have a flash. She's been close to this woman while she's naked. She's certainly being close to her husband while he's naked. Like it wouldn't be that hard to like put them together in some imagined, you know, setting, I guess. And I think that she would be doing that. And then when she has like the vision of her being killed, you know, like, mm-hmm. That doesn't seem like too much of a device for me. What I didn't love is like her walking near Central Park and like seeing her face in the like the advertisement, you know. I don't like those things where people are like, oh, they think they like see the dead person standing across the room or whatever, and then they freak out. It's like, I don't like, unless you're having like a really bad psychotic episode, like does that actually happen, you know?
Sure.
I know that they're trying to show paranoia and whatever, but I think sometimes there are less cliched ways to do that. But I think that the flashes to what Grace imagined that tryst would look like, that to me works, because who wouldn't be imagining that in that situation?
Right. And I think it's also interesting. I mean, it also keeps Elena alive, I think, for us to have her, you know, like to have Matilda and De Angelis like be in these episodes, even as memories, I think is important to like keep her alive. Otherwise, you know, we only have that one first episode with her. And then I on the one hand, I kind of agree with you, but on the other hand, it is interesting how that trope is then sort of flipped on his head, because like Grace keeps thinking she sees Jonathan at the lake house, and then you're like, oh he's actually there.
He was skulking on the rocks.
Lurking behind rocks and like peeking behind windows and stuff like that. So and like, so what, like, I was worried when I was first watching these episodes, I was worried that Hugh Grant was going to disappear for a long time. And I was bummed only because like I like having Hugh Grant's sort of charisma and performance in this show, and I didn't want him to just like vanish for several episodes. You know, what do you think of the fact that he's gone and then he's back by the end of this episode?
Well, that scene is well done. It's also fascinating because when have we seen Hugh Grant act in that way? Like frantic, teary, like, you know, I didn't kill someone, you know, like it. Hugh Grant has had such an interesting career. You know, he's this Oxford guy who was so good looking and posh and like could act, and then sort of fell into it because it was something to do. And I think he, like, for most of his career, like never really liked it and always would say in interviews, I hate acting, I want to retire, whatever. But in recent years has really seemed to find a renewed interest in it, and has been playing interesting different characters, you know, in things like A Very English Scandal or Cloud Atlas or Florence Foster Jenkins.
Yeah.
And he's amazing in that. He should have gotten, or Paddington 2. You know,
should have gotten an Oscar for both Paddington 2 and Florence Foster Jenkins, I think.
Absolutely. And so it's fun to watch him commit and, you know, to really act outside of his, you know, which he could do in his sleep, that, you know, charming, bumbly, erudite British guy thing.
Right.
So I think that, like, because it's such a shock to see Hugh Grant like that in the audience, it communicates what a shock it is for Grace to see her husband like that, because like she says in the interrogation scene, he's a warm person, you know, but here he is like frantic and teary and, you know, talking about this crazy psycho woman who's stalking his family. You know, it's just like, it's such a what if there was a mask, it is fully off. And well, certainly he'd been wearing one for at least a few months if this was all happening and he didn't say anything about it.
Right.
So yeah, I think I like the shock of that scene, and then the episode ends. Like, I think that's a nice abrupt kind of, like, it sort of jolts you forward and you're like kind of bouncing back and forth while the credits roll, and you're like, I need to watch the next one.
Yeah, the other line reading I really like in this episode is him saying encroachment, which is a great Hugh Grantish way of talking about this woman, sort of insinuating her, according to him, into their lives. And the flashbacks or the flashes that Grace has does help illuminate this thing that happens in episode one, where you very rightly were like, we see him at the hospital with his patient before he like slips into bed with her. But it's like, now we understand that that's really just like Grace's memory of him as a pediatric
or fantasy of him in a way.
Right.
You know, exactly. Like doing his caring, but like charming, and
my husband's,
you know,
off doing this right now, sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and for, you know, I would have to imagine that, you know, we have what, four more episodes, that the mystery is going to get let, you know, there's going to be more to it. But I think all of this stuff coming out, because, you know, I feel like a lot of times this would come out in episode five or something.
Yeah, exactly.
But to just put it all up front, I think is a really interesting, like, storytelling choice. And in terms of really accelerating the show's momentum, I think it's pretty successful.
Yeah. And the last thing we should talk about is this idea of paternity, that like he might be the father of her baby, which, you know, is one of those things where now, no matter what happens, I mean, like, obviously there's a lot undone and great, you know, like, let's say we believe what Jonathan says here, and like he had sex with this woman, but he left and he came back and she was dead. Like, let's say that we believe that. Let's say that there is like another, an end to this crisis, this immediate crisis. But if he is the father of that baby, they are forever now linked to this other family because of that. And I think that that's an interesting aspect of all of this.
And Grace realizing, wait. The baby at that thing that we were gossiping about, the breastfeeding with my friends, that baby might be my husband's.
Yeah.
Like, how surreal that would be.
Yeah.
I think that, like, that is a huge, that's a great way of the show to set that up, because the baby serves this function in that scene, because it's like, oh, it's showing that she's different from these other moms, right? And then you kind of forget about the baby, because then it's focusing on the son who goes to school
right
at Reardon, and the son, that's the son who finds her body and all that stuff,
and then sick and all that stuff. Yeah.
And then when the detective is like, the baby, you're like, oh my god, right, like that's the same woman and the same family. And it's a nice shock.
I think you have to constantly re-examine Elena's behavior in that first episode of, like, what she wants from Grace, right? Like, so Jonathan's interpretation is that she's, like, obsessed with Grace. She joins the gym, you know, that she's, like, doing a kind of, like, fatal attraction kind of single white female kind of creepy thing where she joins the gym, stuff like that. But, like, let's think about this idea. Like, she's breastfeeding. We could have our various interpretations of the breastfeeding scene last week, but this week we have to think about it in terms of, like, she, like, this baby is partially her claim on Jonathan, and this is Jonathan's wife who has her own claim on Jonathan. So, like, what, you know, what does that mean? Also, of all the flashes that I liked, actually, the one that I liked the best was when Grace discovers the scarf and the perfume in Jonathan's closet, and she sprays the perfume, and that sense memory immediately, mm-hmm. like she remembers Elena in the locker room, and you're like, she gets, she smells it. She knows what that smells like. I thought that was a really effective use of it right there.
Yeah. Also, it's only somewhat related, but like when, Jonathan's talking about the, but he's telling her everything, you know, and he's like, and I went, you know, and he's like, and we, you know, I went to her and we argued, and then we had sex. And you're just like, oh my God, man. Like, but like, is that him covering bases? Like, to be like, well, they're going to find, you know, DNA.
There's evidence. Yeah.
You know,
I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, Hugh Grant being like, we had sex. So it's pretty great. Yeah. All right. Before we go to our conversation with Nicole Kidman, is there anything else you want to talk about in this episode, Richard?
I love her green coat.
Yes.
I think it also is interesting. It's interesting how much the hair really is bringing me back to like 90s Nicole. And like it makes you look at her different or something. I don't know. It's a subtle thing, or maybe not that subtle. I don't know. But I think her whole aesthetic in the show, is stirring up like, a sort of older affection for Nicole Kidman that like makes you worry for her that much more.
Yes, I love that. What's your like iconic early Nicole performance?
I mean, probably Far and Away, I would guess.
Me too.
Yeah, that was big. I mean, Days of Thunder like was. Well, I didn't quite get what that was doing, but actually, you know, I say Far and Away, but no, it's Dead Calm.
Oh, very good.
Dead that Calm. Movie's excellent, and she's excellent in it, and the hair is in full bloom in that movie.
For some reason, Far and Away was always on the like HBO free preview weekends when I was growing up. And so like my sister and I watched it a lot. We quote that movie a lot. So yeah, you're a carker, Shannon. What a carker you are. Tom Cruise's excellent Irish accent. All right. And on that note, let us go to our interview with Lily Rabe. I want to mention a couple things first. She mentions Donald in the middle of the interview, just, you know, to make sure we're all on the same page. That is Donald Sutherland. She's talking about her character's relationship with Grace's father a little bit, just a little bit, because that's sort of a preview of some future episodes. But the Donald mentioned in the interview is Donald Sutherland. And then also, oh, I kicked off by asking her about Fleetwood Mac season, because if you're an American Horror Story fan, you know that Lily played a character called Misty Day on American Horror Story Coven, who was sort of like obsessed with Stevie Nicks, so much so that the show manifested Stevie Nicks herself on the show. So the rise of Fleetwood Mac on TikTok and other medium, you know, I felt like Lily deserved a little slice of that pie. So that's where we start, and you'll see where we end. So let's go to our interview with Lily Ray.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Complete joy to talk to you. I want to wish you a happy Fleetwood Mac revival season. I don't know if that is splashing back on you in any way, but I always think of you, of course, when Fleetwood Mac is in the news.
Please, always.
I wanted to actually start by asking you about, I was talking to Edgar a little bit about the difference in his experience working on the assassination of Gianni Versace on a Ryan Murphy show versus something like this. And I'm curious for you, since you've done so much work in the Ryan Murphy verse, like what the differences are on this project.
You know, I think one of the most profound differences would be that much of working on Horror Story is like doing a kind of trust fall. There is in the most wonderful way, mm-hmm. But very often going in, you don't know where things will end up. You don't know where the journey that your character is going on will end
right up.
So that's something I love about doing that show, and it's very specific to my experience of doing that show. And it's, you know, it's great to do a trust fall when you know that the person's arms you're falling into is Ryan Murphy. I wouldn't want to do it with just anyone or very many people. But and then with The Undoing, it really felt more like shooting a film because we had Susanna directed all the episodes. We were shooting in such a way where we were block shooting a lot of it, where we were, you know, the crossboarding of the episodes. So that it felt like shooting the beginning, middle, and end of a film, and so really such a different experience in that way. Just the format and what that experience is day to day, in terms of calibrating the arc of your character, and you're using a different skill set, and the experience is very different. But I wouldn't choose one over the other. I think the most important thing is that, you know, at the helm is someone like Susanna Beer or someone like Ryan Murphy, and then I'm on board.
The more I hear about Susanna's process, the more fascinated I am by it. Like whether it's, you know, room for table reads, the extensive amount of coverage she shoots, or one of the most fascinating elements I learned today is about this sort of slow warm up to kind of calling action on a scene. I don't know if you had this experience where she allows you to sort of move through the space before the action really starts going. You know, of all the things that she does that might be a little different from the status quo in terms of her approach, what was most useful to you in your process?
Wonderful question. Something I would say about Susanna, when she first called me after I'd read the first two episodes, and she sort of was calling me to tell me why I should do it. And mm-hmm. I had done a reading for her of a film that didn't get made, but I am such a fan of hers. And I was so eager to work with her, but something she said to me on the phone was that she felt, you know, she wasn't even close to being sort of finished with who Sylvia was going to be, mm-hmm. and that she really wanted to be in process with me. And she had all of these ideas and plans for the character that she wanted to figure out along the way. And the thing is, I have heard people have said things like that to me in the past, and very rarely is it true.
Right.
And she exceeded expectations. It was a constant process of exploration and curiosity and sort of leaving no stone unturned in terms of making sure that we were doing right by the character and doing right by the story. And really, over the course of shooting, Sylvia became something much more than was on the page when I first read it. It was just exactly what Susanna said. But I think, you know, just because someone says something doesn't mean it will be true. But with her, it is true. And it's even better than that.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, of course, if we're coming off of watching a couple seasons of Big Little Lies, we think we know what it means to be Nicole Kidman's friend as she's dealing with a murder. You know what I mean? We think we know what that character might be. I'm really interested because Sylvia in many ways defies boxing, which is always fun and interesting for a character. I don't know what to expect from her. Right. And good. And that's true of like a lot of characters on this season, but I am especially on edge just because I know how much you can do and you're doing it and you can do anything. And so I'm just always on edge to see if like there's going to be a turn or something from her.
I think that's one of the wonderful things about this show, is that you can't get ahead of it. I'm so glad that you felt that way.
As you were reading through the scripts, did you have a certain, you know, I'm not digging for any spoilers or anything like that, but were you convinced you knew what had happened, and were you surprised ultimately by what you discovered?
Yes, I was surprised along the way a number of times. There were times when I was very confident and not wrong ultimately. And then there were times when I would switch and I was then very confident in a direction that was wrong. So, yes, I, reading them, I really had that sort of, and it's hard when you're, cause you could just turn, you could just flip the hand, but I didn't do it.
I'll ask you an easier question. What do you think, when you think of the title, The Undoing, what do you think is undone by this, this whole mystery?
You know, I think even more painful than the undoing of someone who we think we know and love and trust is, the undoing of ourselves and the sort of rollback on our own feeling of confidence that the ground beneath us is solid to walk on, mm-hmm. And not trusting yourself to navigate the world or navigate relationships. I think that's the most difficult of all, because people are surprising in every direction. They can be so surprisingly wonderful and so surprisingly disappointing, and both. Mm-hmm. But it really is in those moments where you realize, you know, you sort of, there's a part of yourself that you have failed to recognize. I think that is to me, sort of the most poignant part of what the title means.
Yeah. That's interesting. I every single person has a different answer for that, so I find that really interesting as well. Something that I know that Susanna likes to do in her directing is these really interesting close-up shots on an item or someone's hands or something like that. What is it like for you to be on the other side of that camera in that process?
You know, it's so hard when you feel like the container of the work that's happening isn't holding the work, isn't seeing the work, and it's not, and that things are sort of spilling out all over the place. But with Susanna, you just think everything is being held. And that's what it feels like to be on the other end of her lens, that you are being seen. I felt that way very much also as just a woman, as a human being. She's, she really sees people. She sees people so clearly. I felt that way so distinctly with her and so immediately with her. But as an actor, you just feel like this scene is being taken care of. And so there's just an incredible trust there, because she is one of those directors who's able to hold the story so seamlessly, with, you know, holding the individual characters, and nothing ever gets lost. So it's a great feeling.
How are we supposed to interpret Sylvia as sort of the one mom who stands by Nicole Kidman's character in all this?
I think that I think Sylvia is so adept at moving through this social circle. Mm-hmm. She's like a great athlete who's grown up playing the sport. Mm-hmm. But I don't necessarily think it's her soul's sort of happiest place. Mm-hmm. I think her truest self sort of lives on the edges, even though the way she functions is right in the middle. And I think that that's a likeness that she has with Grace's character, that they're both outside of it in a way. There's just a likeness there. I think they are sort of, they have something very kindred between them in the way that they can function very well in their environment, but actually don't want to really be right in the middle of it in the way that they are, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does.
It's like the hand you want to hold under the table at an event, you right. know? It's like whether you're actually holding it or sort of invisibly holding it, yeah. That's the hand you want to squeeze and like reach out and know that it's there. And that's sort of how I feel about that relationship. And she's so able to stay on the razor's edge of, I think it's why people gravitate towards her, because even though she knows how to function so well and sort of, you know, she's a manicured person.
Right.
But she's very polished, but she pushes right up against the edge. And I think she's sort of always sitting on that. It's kind of always bubbling under the surface. And I think that Donald's character is like that too. And we sort of talked about how we think that like these families, which had known each other forever. And right. So, you know, I think Sylvia has known Donald since she was teeny tiny. And I think, or Frank, and I think that, they share that kind of just a little bit of wickedness, and being able to sort of exist right in the middle of it and be outside of it, commenting on it at the same time. And they're really dexterous.
You've talked a bit about this, moving through a social circle, concept that's in this show, but there's also this clash of social circles that is so inherent to the show, and the clash of, you know, what's at the center of this privileged world is very white, and what's on the border of it is very, you know, not white in terms of some of the other characters on the show. And I'm just curious for you, if you've thought about the way in which this show might land now in October of 2020 versus when it was originally supposed to air in spring of this year, and sort of where the viewing audience might be in a different place to receive it.
I think any show that holds up a mirror right now and asks its audience to ask questions of itself and to sort of be in a constant aggressive and active conversation and never sitting back, never feeling like there isn't more work to do. Anything that can do that is immeasurably important, and always has been. But I think right now having it air when it does, listen, I'm very excited for people to see it when they'll be seeing it. And I hope that it does. I hope that it helps to continue this conversation that we're having, that there is no more important conversation to be having.
Was there, I'm so sorry. I don't know precisely when this particular interview is going to run, but I promise that if you say anything that is a spoiler of a future episode, I will cut it out. But I'm curious, I've seen 5 episodes. In those first 5 episodes, what was the most challenging thing for you to tackle, to land, to navigate in your performance?
Maybe my favorite challenge was not shying away from the ugliness in my character's relationships, the parts that aren't, that don't have perfectly round edges and that aren't perfectly manicured. And so figuring out and sort of, you know, and joining hands with Nicole and Susanna to make sure that when the sort of shift in their friendship occurs and when that reveal happens, that it's not easy. It shouldn't be easy, because it isn't easy when those things happen, and what happens on the other side isn't easy, because it's real. And it's I think that, you know, so many of the relationships and in this world, they can just skate along the surface and stay above the surface. And so when you sort of like get out the ice pick and they're like, okay, we're going in and it's going to be gold, that you feel like you're really, really properly doing that. That was,
excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you for the chat. I really appreciate it. Thanks for your great work on the shows.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode, episode 2 of The Undoing. Richard, until we're back, we return from the lake house back to the intrigue of New York. Where can folks find you?
Well, I mean, there's so much going on here. I'm going to my beach house. I just can't stay in the city. It's just too much noise, too much distraction. But you know, I have internet there, you know. Okay. No, you hear me, Noah Jupe? I have internet there. So I'll be tweeting at Rylaz and writing at vf.com. Until the next clue reveals itself, Joanna, where will you be?
Well, I, like Lily Rabe, will be going into a diner asking for some water and some privacy, please. And but you can find me on vf.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, and we will see you next week.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.